In commemoration of the 100th anniversary of World War I, Connecticut Explore devoted their spring 2017 issue to the experiences of our men and women involved with the war effort. Here is a selection of articles from that issue.
The first article is written by Christine Pitsley and is titled Remembering World War I. When you read about the United States during World War I, you generally read about the decision makers, like General John Pershing or General Clarence R. Edwards, not the story of men like Private Edward Schaefer or women like First Lieutenant Hannah Horgan. But it is these personal stories that bring history to life and help us understand the war from a whole new perspective. How do we find these stories when the men and women who lived through it all are gone? The Connecticut State Library put that question to the test 2 years ago when it started a community archiving project called Remembering World War I, Sharing History, Preserving Memories. The idea was to create a digital archive of stories and images from World War I told by the families, friends, and neighbors of those who served. We decided we would scan or photograph as much as we could before returning the items to their owners and then make the images available online. We weren't sure how much interest there would be or whether people still had photos or letters, but we were going to give it a shot. It turns out that people have been interested, indeed, and they have tons of stuff. The stories and keepsakes brought to us for scanning are truly amazing. Some people come with nothing but a story or maybe a photo, while others come with boxes of keepsakes, all of them lovingly cared for. Every story, photo, letter, and object is a small part of who we are, and every last piece is important. They help us understand, learn, and teach about the impact these men and women had within our families, our communities, and our state, and the sacrifices they made for our nation. For me, the story of Jacob Bernasconi, a Farmington soldier who served in the 102nd Infantry Regiment, 26th Yankee Division, stands out. Howard Swanson, Bernasconi's nephew, had a few boxes of his uncle's World War I belongings that he wanted to donate to the state library. Jacob never had children, and his nephew wanted to be sure his uncle's service was remembered. Mr. Swanson came to our first event on a cold and rainy Wednesday evening. He brought in two boxes of photos, letters, albums, and keepsakes. Through this project, we were able to preserve Bernasconi's story and his memory for generations to come. The photos included are a few pieces residents from all over the state brought in remembrance of their loved ones. It has been a privilege and an honor to help Mr. Swanson and each person who has attended a collection event to remember the sacrifices of those who served during the war to end all wars. The Connecticut National Guard on the Mexican Border by David Corrigan. Between June 27th and June 29th, 1916, nearly 3,000 Connecticut National Guardsmen left Camp Holcomb in Niantic, bound for the Mexican border. The reasons for their journey are directly related to events stemming from the Mexican Revolution of 1910 and the almost constant state of flux in political and military affairs that followed, and to the long history of instability and cross-border incursions that characterized the region in the 19th and early 20th centuries. On March 9, 1916, the Mexican general Francisco Pancho Villa and several hundred of his troops attacked the small border town of Columbus, New Mexico, an action that left 18 American civilians and soldiers dead and a significant portion of the town in ruin. The soldiers were members of the U.S. 13th Cavalry assigned to nearby Camp Furlong, one of many U.S. military installations that stretched from Brownsville, Texas to Nogales, Arizona. Construction of most of these outposts had begun in the 1850s, following the Gadsden Purchase of 1854, which added much of southwestern New Mexico and southern Arizona to the United States and created a border that needed to be patrolled and secured. Villa had emerged as a popular leader from the political and military turmoil following the Mexican Revolution of 1910, which had deposed Porfirio Diaz, dictatorial ruler of Mexico since 1876. The wealthy class had prospered under Diaz's encouragement of foreign investment and industrialization, while the lower classes and small farmers suffered as a result of his patronage of large landholders and ranchers. Diaz's despotism and repression finally drew a concerted response, and he fled in exile to Paris in 1911. What followed was a decade's worth of rival factions vying for power, with constantly shifting military alliances, pitched battles, and assassinations, and a growing but unanswered demand for broad social reform by the countries dispossessed. By August 1914, Venustiano Carranza had emerged as the leader of the Revolutionary Constitutional Party, recognized by President Woodrow Wilson as the de facto Mexican government. General Villa was allied with Carranza and in command of the troops in the state of Chihuahua and northern Mexico. But a growing dispute between Carranza and Villa eventually led to a decisive battle between their respective forces in November 1915. Villa was soundly defeated, but he remained a threat to Carranza, raiding towns in northern Mexico and attacking Carranza's federal army. His attack on Columbus, New Mexico was an effort to embarrass Carranza and provoke a response from the United States. President Wilson's response was almost instantaneous. On March the 10th, Wilson ordered Brigadier General John J. Pershing to cross the border into Mexico and to undertake a punitive expedition to pursue and apprehend Villa. By March 14th, Pershing was leading four cavalry regiments, two infantry regiments, and part of a field artillery unit on a mission that eventually took them nearly 400 miles into Mexico. Unsuccessful in its objective of capturing Villa, who was at home in the mountains of northern Mexico, and easily eluded Pershing, the U.S. forces were finally recalled in February 1917. Pershing's expedition had angered Carranza and many Mexicans who viewed it as a violation of the country's sovereignty. Carranza had denied Pershing the use of Mexican railroads to move troops and supplies, resulting in the first large-scale use of motorized trucks in a military operation by the U.S. Army. Most of the troops with Pershing had been stationed in forts along the border. But because those forts were undermanned, border towns were seen as vulnerable to attack by bandits or portions of Villa's troops not being chased by Pershing. On June 19, 1916, President Wilson federalized the National Guard and ordered nearly 150,000 National Guard soldiers to report for duty, protecting the border between the United States and Mexico. This was the first time such action had been taken, with Wilson empowered by recently enacted reforms of both the regular army and the National Guard. The guardsmen were to be deployed at strategic points along the border from Brownsville to Nogales, usually in proximity to a regular army installation. Upon receipt of Wilson's order, Governor Marcus Holcomb ordered Connecticut National Guard units to report to Camp Holcomb in Niantic to await further orders from the U.S. government. Units ordered to Niantic were the 1st and 2nd Connecticut Infantry, Troops A and B Connecticut Cavalry, 1st Connecticut Field Company Signal Troops, 1st Connecticut Field Hospital Company, and 1st Connecticut Ambulance Company. Private Ernest F. Smith of Meriden, a member of the Company L, 2nd Connecticut Infantry, noted in his diary that he arrived in Niantic on June 24th around 7 p.m. Got tents pitched about 10:30, then had mess. Nothing of importance happened at Niantic, only regular camp routine and rain. Rookies got initiated. Smith was one of the nearly 3,000 Connecticut National Guardsmen who left Niantic for Mexico between June 27th and June 29th. The Hartford Courant reported that the troops left in 8 trains, averaging 14 cars each. The trains consisted of coaches for the soldiers, flatbeds for ambulances, and supply wagons needed in the field. and boxcars carrying supplies, horses for cavalry troops A and B, and horses to pull the ambulances and supply wagons. Officers were assigned to sleepers, and enlisted men were put in day coaches. 3 men to 2 seats, making for an uncomfortable journey at best. In an attempt to lighten the mood, guardsmen adorned the sides of their coaches with slogans and pictures drawn in chalk. One coach was ornamented with Company L, 2nd Connecticut, Don't Tread on Me. As Captain Daniel W. Strickland later reported in the Mexican Border Mobilization, in Connecticut Fights, the story of the 102nd Regiment, some of these slogans were not very complimentary to the Mexicans, requiring the use of soap and water, much like the treatment mothers used to give little boys for using bad words. Since nearly the entire National Guard was on the move at the same time, with 150,000 troops funneling down toward the Mexican border from every part of the United States, every available piece of rolling stock was put on the rails by the nation's railroads, and military trains were given priority over civilian traffic. All along the route, crowds lined the tracks, cheering and shouting encouragement to the troops as the trains passed by. In his order federalizing the National Guard, Wilson stressed, "This call for militia is wholly unrelated to General Pershing's expedition and contemplates no additional entry into Mexico, except as may be necessary to pursue bandits who attempt outrages on American soil." The Connecticut troops knew that their destination was somewhere on the border, yet as Major James L. Howard of Troop B Cavalry reported, "Youthful imaginations recently had been kindled by a reading of Prescott's glowing story of the conquest of Mexico. To follow the path of Cortez, to storm the heights of Chapultepec after the manner of Tom Seymour in 1846, to look upon the lakes and palaces of Mexico, the most ancient city of America, to encamp among the temples of a vanished race, was ever a more fascinating prospect offered to a soldier of fortune?" This from the Origin and Fortunes of Troop B, James L. Howard, editor, Case, Long, and Brainerd Company, published 1921. Any romantic notions about their duty at the border were quickly dispelled when the Connecticut troops alighted in the border town of Nogales in the blazing July heat. Captain Strickland noted, "The rocky ground was so hot, men stood about on the edges of their soles of their shoes. Almost all of the men started in with the prolonged nosebleed, while a midday sun beat down with a white-gray dust, the temperature being something over 125 degrees. It took several weeks to adjust to the climate, and eventually the troops were exempted from any strenuous duties between the hours of 11 a.m. and 3 p.m. The first night in camp was spent in pup tents, and sentries were posted, since Mexican soldiers were clearly visible across the international border that separated Nogales, Arizona from Nogales, Sonora, Mexico. There were no incidents that first night, and the next day was spent building kitchens, digging ditches and latrines, and performing all necessary duties to get the camp functioning. This choice of a site for the camp, however, proved a disaster when a torrential rain washed much of the camp away toward the Santa Cruz River. A second location was selected atop a broad plateau about a mile north of Nogales, and a regular routine was finally established. Drilling under regular Army officers from the 12th U.S. Infantry, stationed at nearby Camp Stephen Little, began, and most days were filled with such military drills as close order, open order, and combat patrol exercises, troop reviews, rifle practice, and marching. Tyler H. Bliss, a Hartford Courant reporter embedded with the Connecticut troops, described the routine in an August 16, 1916 story. "Another day without event, another day in that long routine of days, a day of drills, of marching, of exercises, of ordinary duties, the sort of day of which we are getting our full share, the sort that makes soldiers, but does not make excitement. From now on, we are given to understand most of the days will be of this sort. The novelty is over. The men are used to Arizona, and Arizona is used to the men." In his diary, Private Schmidt dutifully recorded some of the events that make soldiers, but not excitement. Wednesday, August 23rd, go on rifle range, 5:15 a.m. Practice on 200 and 300 yards. Saturday, August 26th, go to range, 6 a.m., shoot on 300 and 500. And Sunday, August 27th, go to range, 7 a.m., shoot on 600-yard range. The length of the marches in the hot sun with light packs over desert trails gradually grew as the men became acclimated. Such marches culminated, for both the 1st and 2nd Infantry Regiments, in treks to and from Fort Huachuca, a regular army outpost about 60 miles northeast of Nogales. On a postcard with a photo of the fort that he sent to his father, postmarked September 8th, Private Merritt learned of Company L, 2nd Regiment Infantry, indicating the path the regiment had taken through the fort to their camp about 3 miles away under the mountains. He mentioned that some of the famed Buffalo soldiers of the 10th Colored Cavalry were stationed at Huachuca and that we walked about 60 miles, feeling fine. At the end of their hike from Huachuca back to Nogales, the 2nd Regiment rode the last few miles in trucks, perhaps the first use of motorized vehicles by a Connecticut National Guard unit. If the likes of Huachuca were the high point of the infantry's days in Arizona, then Troop B's duty in Aravaca, Arizona, the cavalry's most exciting duty. They, too, had their routine of exercising, grooming, and watering and feeding their horses daily, and they mounted skirmish drills and reviews. On August 10th, Army Brigadier General E.H. Plummer, commander of the Nogales District, ordered Troop B's commander, Captain John H. Davis, and his men to proceed to Aravaca, a small town northwest of Nogales, to establish a camp and begin patrols along the border and among the mining camps and ranches of the surrounding area. As quoted in Origin and Fortunes of Troop B, Plummer selected Troop B on account of the efficiency of the organization. It has no men on sick report, its camp was maintained in a thoroughly sanitary condition, and it is efficient in the performance of all duties that has been given to it. For nearly 2 months, troopers patrolled the border, where numerous trails led into Mexico, including the Smuggler's Trail to Fresnel. On August 24th, they encountered 12 Mexican soldiers who had been staying in a house only 15 yards from the border and who mounted up and rode back into Mexico upon seeing the troopers. They checked on the American miners at the Oro Blanco mining property and at the Montana mine. One of their primary duties was to guard the wagon road that led north from Mexico and was the quickest route to Tucson for any invading force. Captain Davis stated that the territory they patrolled was so hilly that it was impassable to anything but mounted troops. During their patrolling in the Aravaca area, members of the troop carefully mapped the area. Finally, on October 17th, Private Schmidt recorded in his diary that the Connecticut troops strike tents, make up rolls, and general police of camp. Leave Nogales 6:23 p.m. in Pullman sleepers. Within a month, all the troops had returned to their armories and had been mustered out of federal service. On October 6, Secretary of War Newton T. Baker had written to the commanding officers of National Guard units, thanking them for their service at the Mexican border. He noted that when the Guard was called up, the lives of men, women, and children along the southern frontier were in grave danger, owing to formidable bandit raids from the Mexican side of the boundary. With the Guard units arrayed along the border, the raids ceased, and the tension between the two countries began to relax. Baker firmly believed that the presence of the Guard has made possible a peaceful solution of a difficult and threatening problem. Upon their return from the border, the Connecticut soldiers were celebrated with large parades in Hartford and New Haven, where the 1st and 2nd Regiments were headquartered respectively. Connecticut, unlike many states, did not issue medals to its Mexican border veterans, nor did it build a monument to them, as it did for its Spanish-American War veterans. The United States issued medals to both its regular Army veterans and the National Guard soldiers who had served at the border. Many Connecticut veterans could purchase commercially made souvenirs of their time in Arizona, such as one of a variety of watch fobs with the legend "Souvenir of My Life on the Mexican Border, 1916, or a commemorative silver-plated spoon with a camp scene, a fully equipped soldier, and the legend "Mexican Border, 1916, made by the Wallingford Company of Wallingford. Although the Mexican Border Service of the National Guard has faded from memory, its importance should not be overlooked. Within 6 months of the soldiers' return to their home states, the U.S. entered World War I. The first full-scale mobilization of the Guard resulted in a nucleus of well-trained officers and soldiers who had experienced the rigors of military discipline in a hostile climate and received training on up-to-date military weapons and tactics. They emerged from the experience with increased status as a dependable element of national defense. Many of the Connecticut men who served along the Mexican border later distinguished themselves in combat during World War I, when the 1st and 2nd Infantry Regiments were combined into the highly decorated 101st Regiment. As the current reporter Tyler Bliss noted, the Connecticut troops' Mexican border experience did indeed make them soldiers. Letting Slip the Dogs of War by Sarah Jane Cadron. The noise and strain that shattered the nerves of many of his comrades did not impair Stubby's spirits, not because he was unconscious of danger. His angry howl while a battle raged and his mad canter from one part of the lines to another indicated realization. Stubby of AEF enters Valhalla, New York Times, April 4, 1926. In 1917, Corporal Robert Conroy of Connecticut National Guard's 102nd Infantry 26th Yankee Division found new meaning in the phrase "man's best friend." One summer day, while Conroy was training with his regiment at Camp Yale near the Yale Bowl in New Haven, a bull terrier mutt wandered onto the field, scampering between the ranks of drilling soldiers, stopping here and there to greet the men. Corporal Conroy took in the wild mutt, naming him Stubby for his squat, stunted tail, not knowing that by the end of their military tenure, his new pet would outrank him, earning the title Sergeant Stubby. During the course of the 102nd's training in New Haven in the summer of 1917, Stubby became the regiment's unofficial mascot. He followed his new master in training drills day in and day out, until he learned to march in line, recognize bugle calls, and give his own version of a military salute. When he shipped out to France on October 1917, Conroy refused to abandon his new companion. He smuggled Stubby overseas on board the SS Minnesota. Stubby saw his first action on February 5, 1918, on the front lines of the Chemin de Dames. Conroy's refusal to abandon his canine friend proved to be lucky, not only for Stubby, but for the other soldiers of the 102nd Regiment, too. Stubby quickly learned to duck when the men ducked and was reported to have run up and down the lines, locating wounded soldiers and barking to call attention to them until help came. The dog was popular among the men and proved himself to be a surefire morale booster. Stubby's New York Times obituary reported that Stubby once arrested a German spy by crunching down on his behind and refusing to relent until his regiment came to arrest the enemy. His bravery in battle earned him the title Sergeant Stubby and a collection of medals to adorn his new military jacket, including 3 service stripes and a Purple Heart, according to the Connecticut State Library. Meanwhile, back home, Sergeant Stubby's popularity grew immensely, not only in Connecticut, but nationwide, as newspaper articles and photos circulated about the 102nd Infantry's war dog. When the regiment returned home, Stubby marched in parades, rode on floats, and posed for pictures with his fellow soldiers. He was inducted into the American Legion and given a lifetime membership to the YMCA, that included 3 bones per day. When Conroy enrolled in law school at Georgetown University, Stubby went with him, and he was quickly adopted as the school's new mascot. He was known to push balls up and down the football field during halftime, according to the United States War Dogs Association. But Stubby's legacy did not end with celebrations, parades, and paparazzi. With 18 months in battle under his belt, Stubby remains to this day the most decorated canine in United States military history. His actions and the use of war dogs in German and French armies during World War I led to the creation of an official canine military unit in 1942, just in time for American involvement in World War II. The United States still uses war dogs for their heightened sense of smell, acute hearing, and swift reflexes. By the time Stubby died in April 1926, the mutt had become such an iconic symbol of World War I that many newspapers across the country, including the Hartford Courant and the New York Times, published obituaries honoring the stowaway sergeant. Conroy donated his beloved pet's remains to the Smithsonian, where Stubby was skinned and cremated. His ashes were placed inside a plaster cast of himself and his skin stretched over the cast, which wears the mutt's original military jacket. The cast is available for loan when not on display. Stubby is currently on display in the Price of Freedom Americans at War exhibition at the National Museum of American History. World War I Poster Exhibition. Waterbury responded to the April 2, 1917 call to take up arms against Germany by sending 5,000 men and women to various branches of the services. But the war to end all wars did not begin as a popular cause. In order to turn public opinion around, the government mobilized artists to create pictorial publicity for all aspects of the war effort. On the job for victory, World War I posters, on view at the Mattituck Museum March the 12th through April 23rd, offers a selection of approximately 30 posters from the museum's collection. It provides a glimpse of the war front, illustrates participation at home, reveals the new roles of women, demonstrates new technologies, and shows the breadth of military service. Spring in the Garden. In Matilda Brown, Idylls of Farm and Garden, on view through May 28th at the Florence Griswold Museum, independent curator Susan Larkin traces the life and career of a child prodigy. Brown, who lived from 1869 to 1947, made her reputation with highly accomplished depictions of farm animals, of atmospheric Barbizon-influenced paintings. Her embrace of Impressionism is most evident in sparkling paintings of gardens and still lifes of lush bouquets. A catalog accompanies the exhibition, and an exhibition of animal paintings complements Brown's works. On March 16th, attend the world premiere of The Artist's Garden, a new film by Exhibitions on Screen at the Katharine Hepburn Cultural Arts Center. Filmed on location at the Florence Griswold Museum, this production features last summer's blockbuster exhibition of the same name. Curators Amy Kurtz Lansing and Jenny Parsons, and local artists Leif Nielsen, Jack Monmi, and Beverly Shearmeyer. Reservations are required for this event, which features hors d'oeuvres and cocktails before the screening. The Florence Griswold Museum is located in Old Lyme. For the benefit of our children and their children, documenting World War I. Written by Kendall F. Wiggin. In Connecticut, we are very fortunate to have incredible primary and secondary resource materials held in unique collections around the state. The fact that some of the most significant records are held in the Connecticut State Archives is largely attributable to the vision and drive of one man, State Librarian George Goddard, who served from 1900 to 1936. In 1917, the Connecticut General Assembly passed legislation that provided for the depositing in the State Library of all of the files and other official papers relating to the State Council of Defense, the Connecticut State Military Census, and other similar organizations in connection with World War I. At the time, the State Council of Defense established the Department of Historical Records within the State Library under Goddard's direction. On November 2, 1918, the Committee on Historical Records, which advised the Department of Historical Records and was chaired by Goddard, met and decided that is one of the great importance to secure from each of the several committees and departments that had been created by the Connecticut State Council of Defense, a full statement covering the work accomplished or in progress. Goddard was instructed to request with these reports, and on November 14, 1918, just 3 days after the armistice was signed, Goddard wrote to the chairman of the town war bureaus across Connecticut, saying that their reports will be essential to an adequate understanding of the services the committees provided. He went on to say that the Historical Records Committee was interested in having available, when needed, the material necessary to formulate a true and adequate narrative of the part it has been Connecticut's duty and privilege to take. It is the duty of the Department of Historical Records to see that such official and reliable data is secured and made available here in our state library. In 1919, the Department of Historical Records became the Department of War Records by act of the Connecticut General Assembly. The goal of the War Records Department was, according to Goddard, to collect, classify, index, and install all available material relating to Connecticut's participation, public or private, in the World War, for the benefit of our children and their children. So eager was Goddard to show off the work of the Department of War Records that he invited a reporter from the Hartford Courant for a tour. The story appeared in the Courant on July 27, 1919, under the headline, Preserving the Records of Connecticut Soldiers, and the subheading, Our State Leads All Others in the Way It Is Tabulating the Information Concerning the Sons Who Went Forth to Do Their Part in Making the World Safe for Democracy. The reporter noted that Goddard was intensely interested in this work and convinced of the great value of the records the library had acquired and continued to acquire. While many states had found the task of indexing and classifying their war-related records daunting, Connecticut was sailing along serenely under the leadership of the state librarian with a system that is simplicity itself. In 1975, the Connecticut General Assembly repealed the language establishing the Department of War Records and instead substituted language calling for the state library to maintain a collection of war records, which it continues to do until this day. Connecticut enjoys greater breadth and depth of documentation of its role in the buildup of the country's entry into and participation in the war than most other states. Because of Goddard's leadership and innate sense of the importance of documenting history, along with the diligent work of the women and men in the State Library's Department of War Records, today we are able to tell the story of Connecticut's role in the Great War. Connecticut Pioneers the U.S. Navy's First Airship by Roy H. Miz, Jr. In September 1916, an apparition emerged over Hartford's eastern sky, a large, bulbous, cigar-shaped, motorized balloon with a small platform hanging underneath. It meandered in a semicircular path across the sky and then dropped out of sight. The first airship built by the Connecticut Aircraft Company had just completed its initial flight. In the early days of flying, Connecticut had its share of dreamers. Four Hartford men saw business potential in the burgeoning field of aviation and founded a company, the Connecticut Aeroplane Company, in 1913 to explore that potential. Samuel C. Morehouse was a New Haven railroad attorney. Roland S. Woodruff was a former Connecticut governor and now director of several New England railroads, banks, and other corporations. Isaac M. Ullman was head of Strauss, Adler & Company, a New Haven corset and brassiere manufacturer, and Everard Thompson was the builder of the Yale Bowl. Their idea was to build airplanes much as Henry Ford was attempting to build cars. Other manufacturers, including the Wright brothers and Glenn Curtiss, used a custom approach. Each airplane was constructed by a team, mostly using parts manufactured by their own companies. Morehouse and his partners intended to adopt Henry Ford's new assembly line method. They also plan to partner with the best auto supply companies and apply their capabilities to manufacturing airplanes. One barrier to their plan was that court cases had affirmed Orville Wright's monopoly royalty rights on every airplane built in the United States. Morehouse negotiated with him and made the highest bid, but in 1915, Wright sold to New York bidders who had helped him form his first company. Luckily, in 1913, the U.S. Navy started to plan for a future fleet of large dirigibles. It would begin with a small pilot training airship and a school at the newly established Naval Air Station in Pensacola, Florida. The Connecticut Aeroplane Company decided to go after the Navy contract. It changed its name to the Connecticut Aircraft Company to reflect a broader mission. With a good design example and a reasonable business plan, they believed they could be the lowest bidder. Morehouse approached airship pioneer Thomas Scott Baldwin, who in 1908 had designed and built SC-1, the U.S. Army Signal Corps' first dirigible, to work with them. In late 1914, the U.S. Navy issued a request for proposal to supply it with two dirigibles. Several companies bid, but on the basis of design, lowest cost, and Baldwin's cachet, the Connecticut Aircraft Company won the contract. On January 31, 1914, Aeronautics Magazine reported, "The Connecticut Aeroplane Company of New Haven, Connecticut, recently incorporated, now has one of their representatives in Europe, perfecting arrangements, securing data, etc., for a start in February. The company proposes to build a product equal to the world's best in model strength of construction and finish." Connecticut Aircraft Company had 4 months to build and deliver a dirigible by the Navy's October 1915 deadline. The company began construction on dirigible DN-1, in a large commercial building at 671 Chapel Street in New Haven. But as the Indianapolis News reported June 3, 1916, "It was learned today that airship builders have frankly confessed to Navy officials that they are working entirely in the dark in building this type of machine. They have to base the way from the start on information available as to German construction. Officers do not expect great results from the first Zeppelin for the Navy. It will have very limited cruising radius, it is understood, and probably lacks speed, but it will be a beginning of the task." After its test flight over Hartford in September, DN-1 was disassembled and shipped in boxes to Pensacola, arriving in December. Reassembly started immediately inside a 5-story hangar floating in Pensacola Bay. On April 20, 1917, official tests began 18 months late. The next day, the Pensacola News Journal reported, "Leaving the floating hangar at the aeronautic station at 5 o'clock Friday afternoon, the DN-1 ascended to a 1,000-foot altitude, headed across the bay, sailed over Santa Rosa Island, then pointed shoreward, circled over Pensacola, then returned to the yard, a perfect success." Despite the glowing review, the test actually had been a disaster. The DN-1 accelerated slowly and barely met the required speed of 35 miles per hour at an altitude of 1,000 feet. On her final circle, she stopped. The transmission drive bearings had overheated and melted. Engineer Hans Stegel released enough hydrogen to allow DN-1 to descend, and the crew of a powered skiff to capture a tow line and bring her back to the floating hangar. After repairs, new tests began on April 27th. On the airship's final landing, the skiff crew seriously damaged the gondola, towing it back to the hangar. An accident review and final report recommended that the dirigible not be repaired. The Navy deflated the gas bag and scrapped the gondola and engines. Because the company had made a good faith effort, spending far more money than it would receive, and the DN-1 met with requirements for her one successful test flight, the Navy honored the contract. The Connecticut Aircraft Company continued to work with the Navy and collaboratively with several other companies to build a new kind of coastal patrol dirigible in search for near-shore German submarines. All of these B-class airships met the Navy's requirements and performed admirably. By war's end, the Connecticut Aircraft Company's B-15 and B-16 airships had attained the highest speed and longest endurance records across all of the B-class dirigibles. In addition to DN-1 and two B-class airships, the company also produced free-flying observation balloons for Army and Navy airship pilot training. At the end of the war, Connecticut Aircraft Company planned for post-war production. The company looked to commercial passenger and freight airline service using dirigibles, pitching them to investors as more reliable than railroads. Unfortunately, a recession hit in 1922, and the company closed its doors in 1926. Aviation Pioneer Benjamin Fuloy by Thomas Berger. Benjamin Delahoff Fuloy was born on December 9, 1879, in the small town of Washington, Connecticut, the second son of parents who had immigrated from France. His father was a plumber, and young Fuloy seemed destined for a career in the family business. He stood only 5'5" tall, but was an outdoorsman and avid adventure seeker who excelled on the baseball and football fields. Many town natives left accounts of his heroics on the baseball diamond, marveling at his ambidextrous abilities to throw, hit the ball much farther than was typical of players his size, and jump clear over a defender attempting to tag him out in the team's annual 4th of July baseball game. These local accounts serve as the unofficial beginning of the hometown hero legend that accompanied the life of Benjamin Fuloy. In 1893, in a last-ditch effort to take his education seriously, he began attending the gunnery school in Washington. He was never a very interested student, and as his family's plumbing business was booming, he decided to drop out of school and become a plumber. The itch for adventure, however, soon took hold. With courage and legacy on his mind, in 1896, Fuloy hopped on his bicycle and rode it to New York City, around 85 or 90 miles, to enlist in the U.S. Army. He enlisted under his brother's Will's name, because at age 17, he was too young to enlist himself. Thus began an illustrious military career that spanned almost 40 years and an involvement in American military aviation that continued long after his retirement. Fuloy saw active duty first in the Spanish-American War, fighting in Puerto Rico as an enlisted private in the Army. After returning home and still feeling a need for adventure, he re-enlisted as a sergeant and fought in the Philippine-American War from 1899 to 1902. He showed extreme bravery and courage and quickly rose through the ranks, earning praise for how well prepared his unit was and amassing a large collection of medals. Despite his lack of a high school diploma and his origins as an enlisted man, he went to officer training school in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. According to his autobiography and diaries, Fuloy contemplated the possibilities of an airplane and hot air balloon and showed how they could alter military tactics, writing his thesis about the possible use of military aviation. After officer training school in 1909, Fuloy was sent to College Park, Maryland, to receive flight instruction from Wilbur and Orville Wright. He received only 27 hours of instruction before being sent to Fort Sam Houston in Texas with simple instructions: teach himself how to fly. He would become an aviation pioneer, flying more than 100 miles nonstop in 1911, testing the use of radio in flight, commanding a tactical air unit in 1914, and using an aircraft in a combat operation during the Pancho Villa campaign in Mexico in 1916. He became the chief of the U.S. Air Service as part of the AEF First Army, one of the predecessors to the Air Force, in 1918. During World War I, he worked with General Billy Mitchell to learn about the aerodynamic advancements of the Germans and French. At this point, the Germans and French had surpassed the Americans in flight, possessing planes capable of much higher speeds, carrying greater capacity, and far heightened stealth. As peers on General Pershing's staff, Mitchell and Fuloy might have changed that, but they instead became rivals. Mitchell didn't respect Fulwa's lack of education, and Fulwa didn't respect Mitchell's lack of combat experience. Eventually, the command of the tactical air unit was split, allowing both men to contribute greatly to the war effort. Fulwa was appointed chief of the U.S. Army Air Corps as a three-star general in 1931. He convinced President Franklin D. Roosevelt to allow the Air Corps to run the mail service. He was also a close friend of General Douglas MacArthur. Fulwa received some heat over deaths while carrying the mail and was forced to retire, an event that General MacArthur adamantly opposed. Fulwa retired to Ventnor City, New Jersey, and toured the country speaking about military aviation and air power. He was essential to the creation of the U.S. Air Force and sat on the Air Force's first board of directors. At the time of his death on April 25, 1967, the small-town plumber's dropout son had risen to the highest levels of achievement in the United States Armed Forces. Fulwa chose to forego burial in Arlington National Cemetery, where he would have received a large monument, to come home to Washington, Connecticut. He is buried in the Washington Town Green Cemetery. Ruth Hovey, Hartford Hero, by David Drury. Ruth Hovey Ellison, a Hartford hero of the First World War, never fired a shot, but her bravery under fire in France was recognized by those at the highest echelons. She was among thousands of American women who, in the military services or as volunteers with service organizations such as the Red Cross and Salvation Army, risked their lives in Europe. A young nurse with a frontline surgical unit, Hovey showed her mettle treating patients nearly nonstop for days as German shells crashed overhead during the heavy fighting in July 1918. "You needn't worry about me, for we have learned by our recent experience that it is not practical to be so near the firing line," Hovey wrote her mother afterward, vividly describing her experience and glowing with patriotic pride over the accomplishments of the doughboys she served. "Our boys certainly have the right stuff. It's their cocksureness and nerve that makes them good fighters." The youngest of three children, Hovey grew up in a large colonial at 714 Prospect Avenue in Hartford, built by her father, Henry Russell Hovey, the son and namesake of an Essex Sea captain. She graduated nursing school at Presbyterian Hospital in New York City in 1914 and was working at Hartford Hospital in the Social Service Department when the United States declared war on Germany in April 1917. The 27-year-old Hovey enlisted May 10th and was mobilized at Presbyterian with Base Hospital No. 2, an Army Medical Corps unit being rushed to Europe to meet the urgent medical needs of the British and French. The transport, SS St. Louis, left New York Harbor May 14, 1917. On board were the unit's 65 nurses, 153 enlisted personnel, and 26 doctors, among whom was a 28-year-old medical officer, First Lieutenant Benjamin R. Allison of upstate New York. He and Hovey would marry after the war, and much of what is known of her wartime experience is recorded in Allison's unpublished memoir based on his wartime diary. Following a hectic few days of orientation in England, the unit crossed the English Channel on June 1st and was attached to the British Expeditionary Force at Altricot, a lovely resort village northeast of Le Havre. Between 1,000 and 1,500 patients a day were treated at the base hospital there. Shifts could be long and grueling, but there were compensations, good food, pleasant lodgings, and plenty of free time for sightseeing, recreation, and morale-building diversions. Hovey had been to Altricot for 10 months when the war took a turn after the great German offensive in March 1918. Convoy after convoy brought in the wounded, and doctors and nurses worked day and night readying evacuees. Our morale was pretty low during the first week, as it looked as though nothing would stop the Germans, and they would take Paris. "Then perhaps come our way," recalled Allison. The Allied lines held, And on June 16th, Allison and Hovey left Otrita with one of the American Expeditionary Force's first mobile surgical teams. They found time for sightseeing around Paris. In mid-July, while attached to the AEF 42nd, or Rainbow, Division, the surgical team was quartered at a French hut hospital at Bussy-le-Château, a few miles behind the front lines. In the wee hours of July 15th, all hell broke loose with the opening of the Second Battle of the Marne. The Kaiser's artillery sent shells whizzing over and crashing near the hospital huts. Doctors and nurses leaped from their cots and grabbed gas masks. The nurses sheltered in the dugout, a steel-encased bunker providing safety from artillery fire. Patients were moved to the dugout to clear the wards for expected flow of casualties, which began arriving within 2 hours. The operating room was busy during the ground-shaking, building-piercing bombardment. Allison wrote about watching Hovey, an anesthetist, calmly remove her tin helmet to pour ether to sedate patients. A lull in the shelling allowed patients and staff to be evacuated before it resumed again, leaving the hospital in ruins. The Huns had our range exactly, and there is not a doubt but they intended to do as much harm as possible, in spite of the 4 large red crosses we had on our grounds, Hovey wrote to her mother. The relocated surgical team continued treating patients almost nonstop, under periods of shellfire, for the next 3 days. Hovey experienced a severe bout of pneumonia during the Meuse-Argonne offensive. Allison was by her side, nursing her back to health. In February 1919, the men and women of the base hospital No. 2 returned home. Allison and Hovey were married at her parents' home in Hartford on June 18, 1919. The following month, Hovey learned she, along with a small handful of other nurses, was receiving the Croix de Guerre with a Bronze Star by order of Marshal Philippe Pétain and approved by General Pershing in recognition of her heroism. The couple settled in Hewlett, New York. Allison died in 1981 and Hovey in 1986. Hovey's Croix de Guerre always hung prominently in their home. She wasn't shy about that. She was very, very proud, her granddaughter Allison Dean recalled. Connecticut's World War I Memorials by Mary M. Donahue. When most people today hear the word doughboy, an image of the Pillsbury Company's Poppin' Fresh Doughboy probably comes to mind, rather than the American soldiers of World War I. The origin of the term doughboy is murky, but the image defined World War I's troops in the same way the hiker did for the Spanish-American War and G.I. Joe did for World War II. After the tremendous losses of the Civil War, Americans embraced war memorials and monuments on a massive scale. During the 18 months of the U.S. involvement in World War I, 2 million American men served and 50,000 died. Americans were by then accustomed to erecting significant public monuments. In addition to the classic war memorial featuring a figure on a tall base, World War I monuments in Connecticut include a wide range of designs from simple cast metal plaques to flagpoles, commemorative bells, and innovative landscape designs, such as Hartford's now lost Trees of Honor Memorial in Colt Park that featured 213 elm trees to honor those who died. 2 Connecticut monuments that feature the emblematic doughboy are the work of sculptor and persuasive salesman Ernest Moore Viscanay, who lived from 1876 to 1946, a third-generation stone carver. Viscanay developed a now iconic design he called the Spirit of the American Doughboy. A veteran of the Spanish-American War, he was employed at 2 monuments companies in Americus, Georgia, and claimed to have worked with Gutzon Borglum of Mount Rushmore fame while Borglum was working on his Stone Mountain project. According to the E.M. Viscane Doughboy database, Viscanay created the Spirit of the American Doughboy in 1920. The design depicted a doughboy striding forward in an erect posture through no man's land. He wears a flat steel helmet, trousers bloused above the knee, and puttees, or wrapped leggings. The figure holds a 1903 Springfield rifle in one hand and a grenade in his other, upraised, with barbed wire strung loosely around his feet. Viscone copyrighted the design and sold it across the country from his factory in Spencer, Indiana. Miniature versions and lamps were recommended by the artist for local fundraising efforts to inspire donors to make substantial donations. Donors that contributed at a predetermined amount would receive a lamp from the local committee, with Viscone selling them to the committee at wholesale price. He sent fundraising kits out to communities across the country. Connecticut's two verified spirit sculptures are found in Bethel and North Canaan. According to the database, the Bethel monument was chosen after a local resident displayed the lamp version at a committee meeting. The town voted to purchase a copper version of the Doughboy from Viscone, and it was dedicated on May 30, 1928. It was restored in 2016. The Spirit of the American Doughboy could be ordered in three different materials: pressed copper, stone, or cast zinc. Both of the Connecticut examples are of pressed copper. The town of North Canaan's spirit, Doughboy, rests atop a bell-shaped rustic cobblestone base surrounded by low cobblestone walls as part of a town monument to men who served in all wars through World War II. The town elected to purchase a Viscone Doughboy to complete the composition in 1928. Other towns that have monuments that include a Doughboy figure of other than his design include East Hartford, New Haven, and Westport. In Greenwich, a memorial to Colonel Raynell C. Bolling commemorates the man credited as the founding father of the modern U.S. Air Force. Bolling, Assistant Chief of the Air Service, was the first high-ranking Air Service officer killed in World War I. The sculpture's bronze figure shows Bolling scanning the sky. The stele behind him has a relief of two planes among the clouds. The memorial was designed by New London-born Edward Clark Potter, who lived in Greenwich and summered in New London, and is best known for creating the marble lions in front of the New York Public Library. Connecticut pioneers the U.S. Navy's first airship, by Roy H. Miz, Jr. In September 1916, an apparition emerged over Hartford's eastern sky. A large, bulbous, cigar-shaped, motorized balloon with a small platform hanging underneath. It meandered in a semicircular path across the sky and then dropped out of sight. The first airship built by the Connecticut Aircraft Company had just completed its initial flight. In the early days of flying, Connecticut had its share of dreamers. Four Hartford men saw business potential in the burgeoning field of aviation and founded a company, the Connecticut Aeroplane Company, in 1913 to explore that potential. Samuel C. Morehouse was a New Haven railroad attorney. Roland S. Woodruff was a former Connecticut governor and now director of several New England railroads, banks, and other corporations. Isaac M. Ullman was head of Strauss, Adler & Company, a New Haven corset and brassiere manufacturer. And Everard Thompson was the builder of the Yale Bowl. Their idea was to build airplanes much as Henry Ford was attempting to build cars. Other manufacturers, including the Wright brothers and Glenn Curtiss, used a custom approach. Each airplane was constructed by a team, mostly using parts manufactured by their own companies. Morehouse and his partners intended to adopt Henry Ford's new assembly line method. They also planned to partner with the best auto supply companies and apply their capabilities to manufacturing airplanes. One barrier to their plan was that court cases had affirmed Orville Wright's monopoly royalty rights on every airplane built in the United States. Morehouse negotiated with him and made the highest bid, but in 1915, Wright sold to New York bidders who had helped him form his first company. Luckily, in 1913, the U.S. Navy started to plan for a future fleet of large dirigibles. It would begin with a small pilot training airship and a school at the newly established Naval Air Station in Pensacola, Florida. The Bonus Marchers, written by Robert C. Heron, In the aftermath of every war, veterans return home to face the challenges of integrating themselves back into civilian life. This was the case in the early 20th century, when millions of World War I veterans rejoined the civilian population. When the veterans returned home, most were able to reestablish themselves in the boom times of the 1920s. But for many, financial security was tenuous, especially after the advent of the Great Depression. These veterans had been promised the support of a grateful nation, but when they called on that support, they found doors closed to them. They asserted themselves aggressively to claim what they considered their rights. The results would be radical changes to the way a grateful nation provides for its veterans. Fitch's Home for Soldiers and Their Orphans. The Fitch's Home for Soldiers and Their Orphans was founded on July 4, 1864, in the Noroten Heights section of Darien. It was intended for the care of disabled Civil War veterans and the orphans of Civil War soldiers who had been killed in the war. Established by Benjamin Fitch, a Darien philanthropist, in its early years, the facility focused on orphans. It was built at a time when petitioning for assistance was considered an admission of failure, and few veterans were willing to live with that disgrace. Benjamin Fitch died in 1883 and left an endowment for the upkeep of the home. Even with this support, however, the condition of the home deteriorated. By 1888, the state of Connecticut assumed responsibility for its operations. By then, the orphans had grown up and moved out. The remaining population was small and manageable, comprising mostly a few veterans of the Civil War, the wars against Native Americans, the Spanish Civil War, the Mexican Punitive Expedition, the Philippine Insurrection, and small conflicts in the Caribbean and Central America. To the institution's credit, at a time of rampant racism, a significant number of veterans at Fitch's were African Americans. They had served as Buffalo Soldiers, a term used for those who fought on the Western frontier. And with Black Jack Pershing, who led African American troops during the Spanish-American War, and would later become commander of American forces during World War I. By the early 20th century, Fitch's home had become an integral part of the Darien community. Veterans living there participated in town parades, while local volunteer organizations performed various services for the home. In 1920, 250 veterans lived at the home. Life was simple and orderly. Nobody seems to have anticipated the tsunami of World War I veterans that was about to overtake the facility. World War I resulted in a large influx of veterans. Many suffered from disabilities that weren't recognized at the time. Conditions such as mental health issues, substance abuse, and post-traumatic stress syndrome, unless it manifested itself as overt and disturbing behaviors that were categorized as shell shock, weren't treated as disabilities in the early 20th century. Criteria for admission to Fitch's home were usually limited to physical impairments. Even so, a substantial number of veterans applied and were admitted. In 1929, at the start of the Great Depression, Fitch's home housed 217 veterans. The Bonus Army. In 1924, with patriotic fervor at its peak and the economy booming, the United States Congress decided to provide a pension to those who had served in the military. The fund was to accrue interest and become payable in 1945. The Great Depression put otherwise productive men, including many veterans, out of work. The term used for these people was forgotten man. Songs and movies of the era, now viewable on YouTube, provide a sense of the passion and emotion the public felt for these men. Songs such as My Forgotten Man and Brother Can You Spare a Dime, and films such as The Wild Boys of the Road, The Grapes of Wrath, and My Man Godfrey capture the desperation of the times. The public wanted to help, but given the lack of economic resources available, struggled to do so. Destitute veterans felt the bonus money should be released immediately. A movement began to pressure the federal government to pay out the bonus. In spring 1932, 17,000 World War I veterans and their families, including at least 25 veterans from Connecticut, converged on Washington, D.C., and set up a camp of shacks at Anacostia Flats. They hoped to sway public opinion and pressure the U.S. Congress to approve early distribution of the bonuses. The press and the public called these veterans the Bonus Army. Unfortunately, the gathering in Washington caused a backlash of negative public opinion toward the veterans. A powerful bloc mobilized to paint these veterans as slackers and subversives. Congress rejected the notion of paying the bonuses early. On July 7, 1932, the U.S. Attorney General ordered the veterans removed from government property. The D.C. police used force. When the Bonus Army reoccupied the site, the police opened fire, killing two veterans. President Hoover ordered the Army to clear the site. General Douglas MacArthur, exceeding his authority, ordered a cavalry charge, followed by a bayonet and tear gas attack supported by six tanks. President Hoover ordered a halt, but MacArthur continued, dispersing the veterans, wounding 55 of them, jailing 135, killing one pregnant woman, and burning the shacks the marchers lived in. There was a substantial public outcry over the brutality of this assault and widespread public sympathy for the veterans. The Bonus Marchers in Rocky Hill. On August 7, 1932, the 25 Connecticut refugees from the Bonus March arrived home from Anacostia. Sympathy for them was high. The Fitch's facility was unable to absorb this new wave of veterans. The men were sent to the Veteran Supply Farm in Rocky Hill. The Rocky Hill Supply Farm, which had been owned by the Hartford Retreat, a privately owned, state-regulated mental facility, and which provided dairy products and produce to the retreat, had been acquired January 4, 1932. There was no room for them in the few available buildings there either, so they were housed in tents and fed from a mobile kitchen provided by the Connecticut National Guard. The question was, what would the state do with these people in the long term? A plan was proposed to Governor Wilbur Cross to build a new home at the supply farm for able-bodied veterans in need, modeled on the Civilian Conservation Corps camps. The governor rejected the idea, arguing that the proper care of veterans needing relief is a duty of the state. At Rocky Hill, all who need care can get it, not as charity, but as an expression of Connecticut's appreciation to the services of the veterans. This marked a change in the mission of the state's veterans' homes from the care of disabled veterans and orphans to provision of relief to veterans in need. By 1936, there were more than 1,000 veterans in the two facilities. Overcrowding at Fitch's had become untenable. Cots were set up whenever there was room, including in the chapel, where they had to be removed on Sundays for services. In 1936, Congress reversed itself and authorized immediate payment of the bonuses. It was expected that the payments would induce veterans to leave the homes. However, there is an old military expression, "You eat a lot of beans on the outside." Few veterans were eager to leave. Word that there was a haven for veterans at Rocky Hill spread rapidly, and more veterans were entering the homes than were leaving. It was clear that a solution more permanent than tents and mobile kitchens was called for. Plans were solicited for a new veterans' home. After years of political jockeying, in 1936, it was agreed that Fitch's home had to be remodeled or replaced. The location of veterans' facilities was a hot-button issue in the 1930s. There was intense competition among towns for sources of revenue and jobs that visitors, suppliers, and other support organizations might provide. The opening of a veterans hospital in Newington in 1931 is a case in point. Competition to host the hospital was keen between Windsor, New Haven, and Newington. Newington won out because it was located in the center of the state and was easily accessible from many locations. The competing sites for a new veterans home to replace Fitch's were Darien, West Haven, and Rocky Hill. West Haven leaders wanted the new home, because it was the site of a veterans' tuberculosis hospital that the city hoped to expand. Greenwich County politicians fought to keep the facility where it was. Fitch's home had been a part of the community since 1864. When the dust settled, Rocky Hill emerged the winner. The existing Rocky Hill facility was modern, while the Darien facility was showing its age. Rocky Hill was located in the center of the state, and it was in close proximity to the Newington Veterans Hospital. The veterans moved out of Fitch's home on August 28, 1940, departing from Darien's Noroten train station on a special train of 4 coaches and 2 baggage cars. After arriving at the Rocky Hill station, the men were then bused to the new facility at 287 West Street. The numbers of veterans in the system in 1940 dramatizes the impact of World War I on the Connecticut veterans system. Before the move, the 1,000 veterans at Rocky Hill were primarily from World War I. The veterans from Fitch's added 1 Civilian War veteran, 1 from the Indian Wars, 50 from the Spanish-American War, 10 from the Mexican Expedition, and 499 from World War I. Now there were 63 veterans from earlier wars and more than 1,500 World War I veterans. The Veterans Home Today. The Rocky Hill facility originally comprised only the Supply Farm. In 1940, the Gilbert family of Rocky Hill sold 150 additional acres to the state. In 1968, 60 acres of this land were given to the town of Rocky Hill by the Connecticut General Assembly for the formation of Dinosaur State Park. Some of the remaining land contains the Raymond F. Gates Cemetery for veterans and housing for staff. The current home is made up of 40 red brick buildings on land acquired from the Gilberts. Its mission evolved based on the influx of World War I veterans. As wars became more frequent and with an ever larger standing military, the demand for veteran services has continued to increase and the mission has continued to evolve. The home has evolved from a haven for a handful of disabled Civil War veterans and orphans to a larger chronic disease treatment center for veterans of several wars. The 102nd Regiment on the Western Front, by Laura A. Macaluso. After a summer of training at Camp Yale on the grounds around the Yale Bowl on the western edge of New Haven, almost 4,000 doughboys prepared to leave for the European War. The men from across Connecticut who trained in New Haven in the summer of 1917 found camp life more than satisfactory, according to their letters and diaries. Camp kitchens served hot meals, and in between the drills, marches, and trench digging, young men smoked cigarettes and hung around together telling jokes. The Girls' Patriotic League, with a membership of thousands of young women from New Haven, erected 2 tents at Yale Field that summer, and several evenings a week hosted dances for the soldier boys, as local newspaper accounts now held in the files of the New Haven Public Library describe them. In his diary, Philip H. English, a motorcycle dispatch rider with the 26th Yankee Division, 102nd Regiment, and a member of one of New Haven's oldest and wealthiest families, wrote, "Camp Yale was the best home the 102nd ever had." Even a non-human would have agreed with this statement, because here at Camp Yale, a stout brown and white dog named Stubby appeared, whom some say was lured off the rough streets of New Haven to a welcoming center of activity, friendship, and food. The soldiers would soon set off for places they had never heard of, let alone ever visited, French and Belgian towns where millions had already lost their lives. But first, on October 27, 1917, the city of New Haven put on a special event for them in the Yale Bowl. One unidentified newspaper called it the most unique night event, probably, that has ever been seen out of doors in New Haven or this state. 50,000 Connecticut residents and departing soldiers and sailors retreated to a 7-act vaudeville and musical performance, where a perfect fairyland of electricity created one of the most remarkable and indescribable pictures possible, the reporter remarked. after the circus-like acts and the playing of the Star Spangled Banner by the 102nd Regiment Band, the soldiers and sailors stood up and marched across the green grass that carpets the bowl out into the streets that led to their station. According to the newspaper, the cheers of farewell that greeted them nearly drowned out the playing of the great band. The event was planned in exactly 1 week, since the 102nd Regiment had only been officially merged from two Connecticut National Guard units on August 20th. The 1st Regiment from Hartford and the 2nd Regiment of New Haven had both existed since the early 18th century. But upon the U.S.'s joining the war, Connecticut, like all states, had to reach a quota of enlisted men based on population size. By combining the 1st and 2nd CNG into the 102nd Regiment, almost 4,000 doughboys, Connecticut nearly met its quota, though small contingents of National Guard members from Vermont and Massachusetts were added to fill out the ranks. Troops who had served in the Pancho Villa expedition on the Mexican border in 1916 and others took to military life came to train together at Camp Yale. They soon took on an important new identity, that of the newly formed 26th Yankee Division of the American Expeditionary Force, of which the 102nd was placed. This new identity would be strengthened less than a year later when Companies C and D fought at the Toul sector of northern France. On April 20, 1918, 17 men from New Haven, among 81 from the regiment, died together, more than in any other wartime event of the 20th century. This fight became the touchstone for the parades and memorial events in the Elm City from 1919 through the 1980s, when the last New Haven Doughboys died. Joining the war effort. Many New Haveners joined the war effort through support organizations, including the YMCA, the Red Cross, and the Knights of Columbus. Doctors from Yale University and the city's hospitals became surgeons and medics on the front. Men and women became ambulance drivers, and women joined on as nurses or worked in many huts located in camps on the home front and on the western front and managed by the Knights of Columbus. The city's pastoral staff from the First Church on the Green, now known as Center Church, and the Plymouth Congregational Church boosted recruitment by holding 2nd Regiment Sundays in their churches. But they went to France, too. Dr. Oscar Maurer of Center Church went to the front as a volunteer for the Red Cross to attend burials for American soldiers, while Reverend Orville A. Petty of Plymouth Congregational Church, called the Fighting Parson, went to the front as the regimental chaplain for the 102nd. Recruiting got underway in earnest well before the draft began in spring 1917. Men were encouraged to enlist where their skills could be put to use and shamed into enlisting ahead of the draft. In New Haven on June 6, 1917, the Reverend Harris E. Starr, pastor of Pilgrim Congregational Church and chaplain of the Home Guard, spoke to 200 people in New Haven's Worcester Square, saying, "Now is the opportunity for men with aspirations to enlist in the 2nd Regiment. While it will be no disgrace to be drafted, the men who are will be cheating themselves of an opportunity to get out of the draft by joining the 2nd Regiment. The men who are drafted won't be congratulated on the street by friends. To the contrary, they will be considered somewhat shaky and uncertain. If you were a white man between the ages of 18 and 40 and enlisted before the draft called your number, you could choose from a long list of jobs needed to support the war effort. The state of Connecticut and city leaders promoted these options at regiment recruiting parties to raise enlistee numbers before the draft began. Connecticut newspapers reported that 163 men were needed to work as stenographers, storekeepers, cooks, brakemen, engineers, firemen, yard foremen, electricians, linemen, gasoline engineers, draftsmen, surveyors, car inspectors, pile drivers, pipe fitters, boiler inspectors, boiler makers, water supply men, and blacksmiths. Of the 163 spots, all but 43 filled quickly, with blacksmiths being in the highest demand. Men who wanted to join the United States military in this fashion were examined by Major William P. Wooten in New Haven and then sworn in. Some men enlisted with railroad regiments. Small regiments of skilled workers already working for the railroad companies. Railroad regiments went to France to build railroads and run trains for the Allies and the upcoming influx of American soldiers. One of these regiments was assigned to New England, from which 10 companies, two of them based in New Haven, were formed. But it was really the draft that brought in the needed numbers. More than 20,000 New Haven men registered for selective service, with 8,000 claiming exemption due to health or hardship. Only one, Rudolf C. Dahlberg, whose name and address were printed in the city's newspapers, asked to be exempt from service as a conscientious objector. While some New Haven men became members of the 102nd Regiment, others enlisted in the Army divisions or became pilots with the fledgling Aviation Section of the Army Signal Corps, or seamen with the United States Navy. A few joined the British and Canadian Expeditionary Forces, likely due to family connections. Foreign units toured the United States on their own recruiting missions. It didn't become illegal to join a foreign army until World War II. The 5th Royal Highlanders recruited through New England in October 1917. The Black Watch Tour gained 1,000 men, according to one newspaper, including Jonathan Boswell and Donald Bothwell, both New Haveners who served and died with the Black Watch Division of the British Army. The choices for African American men were much narrower. Thousands of black men joined the United States Army, but few ended up fighting at the front. Many were looking for a way to serve their country and for the prospects of greater economic and social opportunity when the war was over. But black men were underutilized and marginalized by the U.S. military, which assigned them to work as laborers, stevedores, and grave diggers. The French Army, by contrast, guided by more liberal cultural attitudes and the need to reinforce their steeply depleted ranks, took two divisions of black men into their army. New Haven's first lieutenant, Charles Henry Barclay, a sign painter who lived on Ashmun Street, was one of these soldiers. His Connecticut Guard Regiment became part of the 372nd Regiment of the 93rd Infantry Colored Division, serving under the French 157th or Red Hand Division. Serving on the front. In the first few days of September 1917, the New Haven Register reported on a few of the first men to leave New Haven for Europe. John Dillon of 56 Bright Street in Fairhaven, a soldier with the 102nd Regiment, was from the Irish-American section of New Haven. Dillon, born in Ireland and still a citizen of that country when he enlisted, was like many thousands of young men who joined the U.S. Army in 1917. Many, like him, were immigrants and first-generation Americans, were not college-educated, and worked in offices, factories, and shops. Another member of the 102nd Regiment, also with Company C, was Edward Schaefer, a tally clerk at Winchester Repeating Arms Company and the son of German immigrants, whose handwritten memoir observed, "My folks loved this country and were surprised at the freedom of opportunity that wasn't available in the old country. They hoped the American people wouldn't be lulled into complacency and let the freedoms be lost." Schaefer's memoir and Dillon's World War I diary, a pocket-sized daily calendar, demonstrate the humility with which both undertook their service. Schaefer wrote simply that their role was to know one's place and duty. A small incident noted by Dillon on September 25, 1917, while he was en route to Europe, is both mundane and touching. A fight he got into with a cook, "Sorry, I hit him," ended quickly. The next day, Dillon wrote, Cook and myself, good friends again. The 102nd Regiment landed in Southampton, England, on October 10, 1917. Dillon described it as one hell of a hole. But it was more introspective upon leaving, writing, "Glad to get out of here. Don't know what we'll hit in France." When the 102nd finally landed in Havre, France, on October 17, 1917, at 1 a.m., Dillon noted that his regiment had to march 10 miles in the rain before a brief rest, followed by another 8 miles that evening to reach a railroad station at 9 p.m. "Rest can't be darned," he wrote. By early November, after a few weeks of training by the French in trench warfare, Dillon reported that the 102nd was inspected by General Pershing, General Edwards, and staff. They didn't do well, according to Dillon. A few days later, the 102nd wore still helmets, replacing soft, less protective campaign hats they'd grown accustomed to wearing during the summer, for the first time. Schaefer said there were no complaints, but the helmets didn't protect the back of your neck. They continued to dig trenches as the weather turned from rain to snow. At the end of November, the doughboys celebrated Thanksgiving with a turkey dinner and pie. The cold days of December and January were taken up with drills to familiarize soldiers with new equipment, including bayonets, automatic rifles, and gas masks. Dillon marked his 22nd birthday on December 17th, but nothing else special is mentioned until his Christmas Day entry, in which he reports having taken Holy Communion at 6:30 a.m., and then going on Bucket Brigade to fight a fire in the guardhouse. Schaefer's memories of his first Christmas at the front were about presents from home. "Our bunks were so covered with gifts, we slept on the floor." On December 28, 1917, in the middle of a snowstorm, the 102nd took over the trenches from the 101st Regiment and began its 11 months of active service on the front. By the next day, Dillon had a frozen toe that bothered him for weeks, a particular problem for a dispatch runner. In the coming months, a sore toe would come to mean little. The 102nd Regiment fought major battles, and Dillon, Schaefer, and the 102nd Regiment were exposed to the full horrors of war: gas attacks, hand-to-hand combat with bayonets, artillery barrage, shrapnel wounds, disease, death of friends, and, as Captain Daniel Strickland noted, ever-present damnable mud all about. No one at the front could write his memoirs without mentioning the mud, but there were also the rats, which were described by Dillon as being as big as dogs. Of the 250 soldiers of Company C, 102nd Regiment, 26th Division, only 43 survived, John Dillon and Edward Schaefer among them. Camp Yale, and that Monday evening under the stars at the Yale Bowl, when flickering lights and music filled the stadium and the city and state cheered for the departing soldiers and sailors, was both 15 months and a lifetime ago. I've been reading from the spring 2017 issue of Connecticut Explored. I'm Rena Tobey,